From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Thou Shalt Not Kill. That one we know, nor lie, or steal, or commit adultery. Beyond that, for many Americans, the Ten Commandments get hazy. But even for those who never learned them in Sunday school, the laws of Moses have weight. My guest tonight, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent Chris Hedges, has looked at how we carry that weight today. Hedges' previous best-selling book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, reflected on the dark appeal of war to the human psyche. Now he's offering his meditations on the Ten Commandments in America. This reporter is a preacher's son with a divinity degree and a penetrating eye, and he's looking at you, me, himself, all of us, and how we obey and stray and live in the light of commandments we may not even know. Tonight on Point, Chris Hedges on the trail of the Ten Commandments in America. You can join the conversation. Do you remember what they are? Do you care? Do you live by them, religiously or otherwise? Does America? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent Chris Hedges. His new book is Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. Chris Hedges, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. You spent a lot of time watching a lot of human life around the world and in the United States. We know you're a preacher's son. We know you've got a master's degree in divinity from Harvard Divinity School. But what put you in the mind to dive into the Ten Commandments, Chris?
Because I think they deal with the core violations of human existence. I mean, most of the commandments are beyond the scope of law. Only murder and theft are incorporated into our legal system. Adultery used to be, but no longer is. I think that's what makes them so powerful. Also, because of the fact that the commandments were created to sustain and nurture community, This was the first attempt by a settled community that had been nomadic to find ethical or religious or moral laws that would hold community together and make community possible.
Chris Hedges, are you here to judge us? Are you holding the Ten Commandments up against the population of the United States and each of us?
I wouldn't say judge. I think what's interesting is to use them as a prism or a lens by which we look at American society. So all of us struggle on a very visceral level with at least one of the violations or issues raised by the commandments. I mean, we can't protect ourselves from theft, from greed, from murder, from adultery, nor always from the impulses that lead us to commit these acts. And I look at the commandments less as sort of a strict legal code. I'm not sure how you could ever legislate, for example, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, or you shall not take the name of your Lord, your God, in vain, or honor your father and mother, but more as moral parameters or guideposts that steer us in the right direction, away from a society that is so much about self and frankly, so much about idolatry.
Though we've seen countries in the Middle East where religious edicts along these lines are incorporated into law that laps into the civil. I'd like to get just some of the basics straight here. I'd love it, Chris Hedges, if you would take us back, because the Ten Commandments, I have to admit, after, you know, five or six, I'm just asking around today, I see they get hazy for a lot of people, and the background as well. I wish you'd just read us the first couple of paragraphs from your prologue here to put this sort of the tablets in context.
The commandments are a list of religious edicts, according to passages in Exodus and Deuteronomy, given to Moses by God on Mount Sinai. The first four are designed to guide the believer toward a proper relationship with God. The remaining six deal with our relations with others. It is these final six commands that are given the negative form of "you shall not." Only two of the commandments, the prohibitions against stealing and murder, are incorporated into our legal code. Protestants, Catholics, and Jews have compiled slightly different lists, but the core demands of the commandments remain the same. Muslims, while they do not list the commandments in the Quran, honor the laws of Moses, whom they see as a prophet. The commandments are one of the earliest attempts to lay down rules and guidelines to sustain community. The commandments include the most severe violations and moral dilemmas in human life. Although these violations often lie beyond the scope of law, They were for the ancients and are for us the rules that, when honored, hold us together, and when dishonored, lead to alienation, discord, and violence.
Chris Hedges, with a couple of explanatory paragraphs from the prologue of his new book, Losing Moses on the Freeway. I guess we should go straight to that title, Chris. Losing Moses. Are you suggesting that we've wandered? Has mankind ever not wandered from the Ten Commandments?
Humankind has always wandered from the commandments. I think, the point of the biblical story when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai and finds the children of Israel worshiping the golden calf, listening to the glib and eloquent preacher Aaron. That's probably our fate, always to wander. I think the commandments are a call back towards that which sustains life, that which calls for self-sacrifice, that which frees us from our idols, that ultimately which makes love possible, not sort of Hallmark sentimental love, but love in terms of inclusiveness, love in terms of nurturing and protecting and sustaining life at the expense often of our own careers, our own status, sometimes even our own happiness. I think one of the reasons the commandments 6,000 years later still resonate is because they capture that kind of wisdom, that direction. They point us in that direction towards human fullness that, of course, human folly repeatedly seems to draw people away from.
Chris Hedges is with us tonight, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent. He's written about the Ten Commandments in America, how they're observed, how they're ignored, how they undergird society, how they do not. Chris, I think we'd better go straight to the job here. You'd better take us through the ten, because, as I say, a quick check today, I found a lot of people petered out about halfway through. Please, give us the list.
You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor your father and your mother. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house.
There is a big list, and cumulatively a high bar. Chris, you went kind of through your life and into the country to find stories that illuminated each of these. And I want to go through those tonight because they illuminate how you see each of these commandments, and how you see the country observing them in many ways. But all in all, do you find that this religious, ancient list of ten is timeless? Does it apply now? Is it, there's such a controversy in this country about where this list of ten commandments is appropriately displayed and not. Is it relevant? Is it more than relevant? How much weight should it have?
I think it's completely relevant, I think the wisdom embodied in the commandments is the wisdom that is ignored at our peril. Having covered things such as the war in Yugoslavia, I have in essence lived in societies where thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, people are violating almost every single commandment on a daily basis. And these kinds of societies are life-negating and dangerous and frightening places to be. Yes, I think that the power of the commandments is not in their narrow interpretation, in this sort of literalist or legalistic interpretation, but in the fact that they deal with, what Marcel Proust used to say, the real news of our lives never appears in the newspapers, deals with these terrible dilemmas. I mean, it's always interesting being a reporter because so often not only do you learn, but you shatter many times your own assumptions. But it was, at all walks of life, I found people who struggled on a deep level, from the pain, either from violating the commandment in the case of, you shall not kill, or when I wrote my story about you shall not commit adultery, there was the life of a young man whose father was in a committed relationship and had an affair. He was the product of that affair. He never met his father till he was 21 years old. For him, adultery is not an abstract issue. It's something that colored his life, just as you shall not kill is not an abstract issue for Bishop George Packard, who was a platoon leader in Vietnam. I think the other interesting thing is I found is that so often in these cases, the commandments choose us. We don't choose them.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we're not always able to, however hard we work, insulate ourselves from our own fate. We can't save ourselves from acts of betrayal or theft or envy or greed or deception or murder. And we're not always able to save ourselves from the impulses that propel us to commit these acts. And all of these violations, which often are committed without any kind of warning at all, I think leave lifelong wounds. And certainly going out as a reporter and using the commandments as a kind of lens or prism made me realize how profoundly people wrestle with one or more of these issues that are raised in the commandments.
Chris Hedges, please stand by. We're going to come back and look 1 through 10, at least as many as we can get to, at how Americans are standing up to these commandments, what Chris Hedges has found in his survey of American life, of his own life, of how the Ten Commandments play out. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you remember what they are? Do you care? Do you live by them? And what's the role today of 10 rules that the Bible tells us Moses brought down from the mountain from God? Are you looking for commandments, for rules to live by, or are you leery? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Ten Commandments and what they really mean for Americans today. My guest tonight is Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent Chris Hedges. His new book is Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. You can join the conversation. Do we need divine commandments to tell us not to lie, not to steal, not to kill? And how do you see the commandments used or abused or forgotten today? Is it old-fashioned to take guidance from the ancients, or is it wise? Is it necessary? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Chris Hedges, you quote the book of Matthew saying, if you would enter life, keep the commandments. On the other hand, you quote Mark Twain saying that an ethical man is a Christian holding four aces. You say that you've not only known life as a preacher's son, you say I also knew you'd write the church's dark side, its self-righteous smugness, its crushing piety. Are you a believer, a religious man? Is that what draws you to these commandments or not?
Yes, but I think I learned to distinguish between religious institutions and oftentimes the veneration that we give those institutions and the edicts and laws passed by those institutions. The theologian Paul Tillich wrote that all institutions are inherently demonic, by which he meant that institutions which are ultimately care about their own perpetuation and survival very rarely can, and probably never, reach the morality capable of being reached by the individual. In the first commandment, where you shall not have no other gods before me, I write about going into Roxbury, the ghetto in Boston, living for 2.5 years across the street from the Mission Main Mission Extension Housing Project, and my motives for that. And I think the learning that motives are always mixed, that in many ways what I was doing was worshiping my own virtue. I had made an idol out of my own goodness. I learned my own complicity in the multifaceted forms of oppression that beset the poor. I think that the other great lesson for me when I lived there and commuted into Cambridge to go to Harvard Divinity School is the hypocrisy of many religious liberals who purported to speak on the behalf of the oppressed and the poor, but of course never met them, had no contact with them at all.
You write about a day when your car's gas line had been cut, your motor mount had been sawed off, the police advised you. They kind of got your number, and they said, listen, man, you're not going to get anywhere by being nice. When you are nice, it is weakness. But the preacher that you heard that Sunday said the opposite. He said, when your enemies destroy your goods, rejoice. And you write, his response symbolized for me how out of touch liberal theology is with the world, blunted by too many years catering to the comfortable in affluent suburban churches, rendered hollow by platitudes and the naivete of the pampered and protected. So you say, through this, you saw that the God you had put before, the God you ultimately came to, was a kind of self-satisfied virtue out of touch with how tough things are?
I think that's the God that many liberals have created. And I think many liberals, because they live in enclaves where they essentially remain untouched by this kind of poverty and oppression and violence, have created a God in their own image, which is what idols are. That there's, you know, even when I was in divinity school, there was a real focus on what we call the spirituality movement, which for me seemed deeply narcissistic. So I'm not sure what it makes me anymore religiously, but I had a terrible time, you know, coming back every night from the divinity school at Harvard into the projects, and realizing that, you know, these were people who liked the poor, but they didn't like the smell of the poor.
So one thing you found was that the kind of clarity that you thought you went in there with went away, and that actually brought you closer. You quote in the opening of the book, the front piece here from Exodus 20:21, and the people stood afar off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. In some ways, losing your sense of clarity was important to getting close to mystery.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's precisely the point, that it's when we think we understand, when we believe that, you know, we know not only the will of God but can act on behalf of God, that we're confused. It's only in the darkness. It's only in our own confusion that I think faith is finally possible. And for me, the church in many ways was my last refuge of God. Mm. And that in that first struggle with that first commandment, in order to find God, I had to shatter that moral certitude. I had to seek forgiveness. Idols promise us power, and God does not. I think before God, we're all powerless, we're all afraid, and it's in that fear, in that darkness. Anybody who's lived in the inner city knows that all darkened areas, alleys, unlit sections of streets are fearful places, because to walk in there, to walk into that darkness, is to walk into the unknown.
Chris, we've got nine more commandments and not infinite time here. I wish you'd give us kind of a thumbnail, a nutshell of what you've got for some of these, the story you found and what you took from it. Idols. You found a fanatical fan of Phish, the musical group, and you made her the centerpiece of your look at idols in America.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, the people who became completely devoted to this jam band Phish when it was around, very much like the Grateful Dead, migrated from city to city. They didn't have jobs. They lived in parking lots. And they were fleeing, what they thought they were fleeing from is the sort of shallowness and emptiness of consumer society, but they recreated in many ways a mirror image of that society. They lived for these ecstatic moments at the concerts, often drug-induced, and that became the goal of their life. Again, it was a form of narcissism, a form of self-exaltation, and ultimately very self-destructive.
Now, let me ask you, I would think that idols are something that many Americans would have a version of in their life, maybe not following Phish around the country, but there are thousands of ways to put an idol. But when you look at that, let's say there's an American who's not particularly religious. What does the worship, whether defined that way or not, of an idol cut him or her off from?
Well, you know, the theologian Augustine said there were only two forms of worship. There was worship of God or worship of self. And that when we create an idol, whether that's power, whether that's status, whether that's money, whatever it is, that idol ultimately is a form of self-worship. And what it cuts us off from is other people. And, you know, I quote Dostoevsky that, you know, hell is the inability to love. Certainly the people I write about in the book who suffer the most are those that grow up in a life without love.
Let's look at You Shall Not Kill. You mentioned Mr. Packard, Bishop George Packard, and his time in the Vietnam War. What did you see in that? What did you take away? We're at war again. You know a lot about it. What does it tell us about this commandment?
He had to struggle as a platoon leader, a highly decorated, he was awarded the Silver Star in Vietnam, officer with not only the fact that he killed, but that he murdered. He murdered the wounded. The cries of the wounded would give away the position of his platoon, and so they were swiftly dispatched after an ambush. And that is the distinction, I think, from killing and murder. There are theologians who argue because of the Hebrew word that it's thou shalt not murder. That's not a debate. I acknowledge it, but don't get into it. I think what is interesting is that Packard, who went on to become an Episcopal priest and then a bishop, had to struggle with the fact that although he was lauded by the state for his actions, he violated the commandment. These are his own words. And in many ways has, since the Vietnam War, lived his life as a kind of atonement, that during the war his job, which he admits to being proud of, was to take life, to destroy life. And everything since then has been an effort to affirm life. There's a great book by a former Catholic chaplain in Vietnam called Out of the Night, The Spiritual Journey of Vietnam Vets by William Mahady. And he writes that in theological terms, war is sin, and that that has nothing to do with whether a particular war is justified or whether isolated incidents in a soldier's war are right or wrong. For him, the human enterprise of war is sin, that it's a form of hatred for one's fellow human beings, that it always produces alienation and nihilism and represents a turning away from God.
So all wars, a breaking of one of the Ten Commandments?
Yes. When you engage in an act like that, when you take human life, you are violating the commandment. And there's a wonderful passage that, I quoted from from Mahady's book, where he is talking about being a chaplain and he said, consider the question. This is that a soldier comes to him and says, "Hey, chaplain, how come it's a sin to hop in bed with a mama-san? This would be a prostitute, but it's okay to blow away gooks out in the bush." And he said that question, forced him to confront, of course, the commandment itself. And how is it that with a clear conscience you can spend a year in a war zone killing people but place your soul in jeopardy by spending time with a prostitute? And that if the New Testament prohibitions of sexual misconduct are to be strictly interpreted, then why not Jesus' calls against violence or the call against killing? I think that it's important to remember that, whether through intention or action, all of us on some level violate the commandments. The commandments are our guideposts. They're a way to point us back to the right path. But with any honesty, we've not all kept the commandments, none of us.
Well, that's for sure. Chris, I just stand by. A lot of people want to join this conversation. I want to begin to invite them in. James is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, James. What do you think?
Hi. I'd like to thank Mr. Hedges for writing. I found his prior book really harrowing. I'm coming to this conversation as an atheist, not from a hostile point of view, but someone who is just raised without religion.
Yep.
And I do have moral values that aren't based in the Bible, but I've read the Bible a lot. And something that keeps coming back to me again and again and again is this notion of 10 named commandments. They were put right out there on Judge Roy Moore's monument.
This is the Alabama Supreme Court justice who got kicked out and now may run for governor of Alabama.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I can't find in the Bible is a place where God actually says, he says at one point in Exodus, "I have 10 commandments," but he never says which ones they are. And you folks were talking about Exodus chapter 20.
Yes.
If you go right on to chapter 21, there's no point of delineation. And the first thing he says is, these are the further judgments. He says, these are the judgments which thou shalt set before them. And he moves right into discussion of how one can be a moral slaveholder.
If one
has, for instance, right there, on chapter 21, verse 4, if a master has a slave who has a wife and who has children, then if you set the male slave free, the child and the wife must, according to God, be left behind.
James, we'll look at that. Why there are 10 instead of 10,000? But let me ask you, as an atheist, I just want to know, do you find, in that position, do you find the Ten Commandments oppressive, illuminating, irrelevant? How do you look at them?
I think they're an illuminating example, not because they come from God, but because I think they're an illustration of something that's conceptually prior. And for me, it boils down to the golden rule, which is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Mm. And the reason I believe that that's a central moral value for societies, not just for individuals, but for societies, which I think addresses some of Mr. Hedges' problems,
yes,
is that it works. It binds a society together. Social psychologists have found this at the small and medium scale.
So there's wisdom here, even if you take the received from God out of it. But let me pick up your question with Chris Hedges. Chris, James says, why not 11 or 12 or 13? And if you include all those, suddenly you've got slaveholding in the commandments.
Well, you know, the Protestants, Jews, and Catholics have compiled slightly different lists. You know, what I did is essentially draw from the religious tradition. He raises a good point. Slavery is sanctioned in the Bible, not only in the Hebrew Bible, but also in the New Testament. St. Paul talks about slaves being obedient to your masters. There are condemnations of homosexuality. Not Jesus never does it, but it happens in Leviticus.
So are you standing up for those too, or are you saying...
No, I think the problem is that people who claim to take the Bible literally, it's always a selective literalism. They pick and choose what they want. And this is with that whole issue of creationism, this is a terrible distortion of what the writers, in my mind, of the Bible were trying to do. The writers of the book of Genesis basically thought the earth was flat and with water above and below it.
So why were they right on the 10 and wrong on 11, 12, 13?
Well, I think that the 10 commandments are about community and the creation and sustaining of community. The laws in Leviticus and the other laws, which are very specific, I mean, for instance, you can only wear clothing of one cloth, you're not allowed to touch pig skin. I mean, the commandments tend to shy, the power of the commandments is that they tend to shy away from those very specific legalisms and deal with, as I said before, moral violations or values that are beyond the scope of law that have to do with our relationship with God, our relationship with others. And that's why, for me, the commandments are so, you know, there's pretty good evidence that many of the commandments were around before the Bible. They come out often, scholars say, out of something called Hittite covenant treaties. And if you look at other religions that have that have tried to establish an ethical and a moral code, that code is strikingly familiar or strikingly similar to the commandments themselves. If you take the Eightfold Path known within Buddhism as the Wheel of Law, it also forbids murder, unchastity, theft, falsehood, and especially covetous desire. I mean, even the ancient Egyptians, when the soul went into the underworld, the soul was asked, I think it was 42 or 44 questions, that boiled down to whether or not they had lived a moral and ethical life.
So, Chris, when Judge Roy Moore in Alabama goes down fighting to have those Ten Commandments put right in front of the courthouse, are you with him or against him if they're so important?
I'm completely against him because what they want to do is incorporate their very narrow interpretation of the commandments into law, to turn the commandments into legalisms. And how can you turn remember the Sabbath into law? How can
it's
you,
been done. I mean, there are countries where that
done
is law.
Yes, and those are called tyrannies. What you do is you create a despotic state where you impose your particular and peculiar moral code, if you want to call it a moral code, on others. There is within the far-right Christian movement this call to expand the death penalty for moral crimes, which they very much draw or use as a basis for this is the commandments. But for me, very few of the commandments lend themselves to the legislative or the legal process. And that's the power of the commandments. I think that they're missing the point.
You say take them to your heart. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight with Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent, author of the new book, Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. You can join us. Are we too smart, too hip for the laws of Moses? Or do we need them badly? And can the commandments themselves be made into an idol? Have they been? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Ten Commandments and what they really mean for Americans today. You can join the conversation. How many of the Ten do you really live by? And does embracing what the Bible tells us is divine guidance mean giving up thinking, or does it mean thinking more? We're at 1-800-423-8255. My guest tonight is Chris Hedges. His new book is Losing Moses on the Freeway. Tim is calling from Putney, Vermont. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess I find that the commandments are a little too simplistic to deal with the more subtle issues I deal with every day in my life. I don't deal with issues of, whether I'm going to kill somebody or steal or commit adultery.
You've got narrower ethical issues that you're dealing with?
Yeah, I think I would call them more subtle. Mm-hmm. Things like environmental issues. How do I take care of the environment, how much is it? How ethical is it to drive my car 100 miles a day or, that sort of thing.
And so they may be good for, Sunday school class, but not for your more...
Yeah, I think they're fine for teaching a four-year-old, not to do these things. But I think as an adult, I feel like on a day-to-day basis, I deal with much different issues. And, there's a lot more gray area there. It's not quite so black and white.
We got it. Tim, let us pick it up. And thanks, Chris Hedges. How about it? There's a challenge that says these are too broad. What could fit on the tablets was not subtle enough for Tim's challenges.
I think that's the power of the commandments, is they were meant to be broad. And, when we talked earlier about incorporating them into the legal code, what they were doing is a kind of winnowing way and narrowing them down. When I first came back to the United States after almost 20 years of being overseas in New York, I saw a film by Krzysztof Kieslowski called The Decalogue, which is the classical term for the commandments. And he made 10 pieces, all filmed in a Warsaw housing complexes, that dealt on a fictional issue, but very powerfully and I think quite intelligently and thoughtfully with the commandments. And when he did the one on adultery, the woman wasn't even married. It was just a series of carnal relationships without love. I think that when we stop thinking of the commandments as a rule, like you would put up, when you go to a public swimming pool, and more as something that we must confront and will have to confront in our lives, think of them as kind of the structure, the foundation by which we can go forward and make these subtle moral decisions that your caller quite rightly and importantly raises.
So then
the commandments, I think, you breathe life into them. You understand their vitality and their importance.
So when Tim raises environmental issues or whether or not he should drive 100 miles an hour or have an SUV or a hybrid, or do you see those as falling under, I don't know what, greed, envy, are they covered?
Well, certainly greed. I mean, why are we the greatest emitter of greenhouse gases? Why do we consume 25% of the world's petroleum supply? Why do we live in such luxury and treat the rest of the world, the vast majority of the world, living on less than $2 a day with such callousness? The human community extends beyond the borders of our own country. When you create these exclusive covenants built around race or class or gender or religion or nation, these inevitably carry within them the denigration of others. They are false covenants, and they divide us. And I think the covenants of the commandments, they extend to all of humankind, and they give us life.
Let's get another call. Ellery's calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Ellery, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm very disturbed by this idea that the Ten Commandments are the basis of morality. The United States Code runs to 35,000 pages or more now, and I think that covers
legal
a
code.
Whole lot of different issues than are represented in the Ten Commandments.
So do you see value in them, or do you see them somehow...
I see that every society has developed laws against murder and theft and various things, but I find that the Ten Commandments represent a particular view of a particular kind of God that is represented in the first five of these, and that is not representative of the diversity of the religious thought in America.
So when they're held up, is it strictly to you an offense to diversity, or is it an offense to some picture of the way the world ought to be that you carry?
It's an attempt to exercise the power of certain religious groups to present their particular views on the morality and the politics of America.
Elroy, stick with us. Chris Hedges, you do point to the Eightfold Path, to Hinduism. You point to the codes of other religions, but is there a kind of religious imperialism implicit in lauding one set of rules, in lauding the Ten Commandments? Does it have a place in our multicultural society?
I think it does, only because it grapples, again, with these very severe dilemmas and struggles of human existence. I don't want to turn the Ten Commandments into another idol. I don't want people to bow down before them. I don't want people to think that that idol is somehow so powerful and so important that all other moral discussion or all other attempts by other religions to grapple with mystery and the transcendent should be ignored. And of course, that was very much part of my prologue. Mm. I think that what's fascinating about the commandments is that, you know, like most religions, it is an attempt to discuss value and meaning. And that, I think what your caller is rightly worried about is this literal interpretation, which is, this literalism does lead to, I think, the opposite of often what it's intended, which is a kind of intellectual and moral blindness
intolerance. You write that all states and nations work to pervert religions into civic religions, one where the goals of the state become the goals of the divine. Do you see that going on in this country?
Certainly. That's one of my worries, that when the goals of the state become transcendent, when the national and the religious symbols are fused into one, when we as a nation feel that not only do we understand the will of God, but have been anointed to carry out God's will in a kind of Christianizing not only of our own population, of the rest of the world, then I think, at least from my reading, what we've done is created an idol. Idols always, of course, are created in our own image, and it's only when we listen to other voices that are often very different from our own, and experiences that are different of our own, that we open ourselves to the possibility of transcendence and mystery.
Chris, I want to get one more call here. Lois is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Lois, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm calling. I grew up Catholic with the Ten Commandments and have gone somewhat away from that, but I found a book called The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz, and I find those four agreements or four commandments to almost be more pertinent to the way that I live today.
Are they four that are part of the ten or separate entirely, Lois?
They're separate entirely.
Give us an example.
One is be impeccable with your word, and it's about not only speaking well about others, but speaking well to yourself in the way that you take care of yourself. And it has to do with the lying and how you treat others.
So when you grab onto a different vine to swing with in your life, Lois, do you feel that that you're offending religion or that you're losing the value of the ancients? Do you feel utterly free to choose your own commandments?
Well, I find that this is another part of ancients. This comes from Toltec wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's not negating what I was brought up with, but it seems to simplify it.
And maybe make it more directly usable to you. We hear that. Lois, our time is so short, but thank you for your call. Chris Hedges, how about it? Are you... Is it the Ten Commandments first in line, or are you willing to look at the four here and the eight there?
I don't like the idea of it being first in line. Having lived in other societies with other cultures and other religions, I've certainly learned a lot from Islam, from Hinduism, it's not a matter of being first in line. It's the fact that I think that the commandments do have a kind of wisdom that we ignore at our peril. I think that kind of chauvinism, that religious chauvinism, is what gets us into trouble. That's dangerous. It works, and it has worked. It's worked for thousands of years, just as I think the Eightfold Path in Buddhism works for many in the East.
Chris, give us another of your stories in a nutshell. Maybe greed, if you can tell us what you focused on there, what you found, the lesson you drew.
Yeah, I went to one of the followers of the self-help guru, Tony Anthony J. Robbins, in Madison Square Garden. And I think it just epitomized so much of American society, that call, his words, to be excellent or to be extraordinary, to raise ourself above others. I mean, when I was there, called on everyone in the theater in Madison Square Garden to stand up on their seats and do these loud booming speakers sing to that Tina Turner song, "I'm the best, I'm better than all the rest," you know. And I think that in a sense is tragic in a way, because he is trying to tell us that we don't have to deal with our own ordinariness. I mean, Faulkner had that great line that every life viewed from the inside is a failure. I think that many ways what spurs not only his followers on, but many people who believe that their potential means that they must be in the eyes of society a success, what spurs them on is that notion that somehow, people will see that they are inside the very people Anthony J. Robbins despises, i.e. ordinary people, as we all are. And that sort of attempt to be extraordinary is dangerous because, of course, it puts the primacy of self first. The manipulation, it calls for the manipulation of others, and it calls for personal enrichment, often at the expense of others. And I think that is so much a part of our society and runs completely contrary to, in this point, what the commandments are telling us, the way we should be living.
Lisa's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa. What do you think? What do you know?
Well, I was brought up in the Jewish tradition, mm-hmm. and I went to college and have a graduate degree, and what happened to me is I'm severely disabled. Mm-hmm. So I sort of live between two worlds, and I have the education, but I'm dependent on Social Security disability, and mm-hmm. many of the programs that are being incredibly threatened by the people in Washington, and I watch as certain voices are not listened to or considered important or remain part of the issue, and I think of the Ten Commandments, and I think of justice. Mm. And not killing, which, not feeding someone. There are many ways of killing off people or not giving them a stipend on which to live.
About poverty or about those in need.
Mm-hmm. Those in need, yes. And that's not even a central part of the political or journalistic discussion. And it seems to me that that is so much part of the religious tradition. Many of the main religious traditions in this country right now, that Christianity or Jewish or I'm sure many traditions that I don't even know about.
So Lisa, let me ask you, when you see the Ten Commandments paraded by some, let's say, Christians who are very politically active, do you see them sort of delivering on those?
I don't see them delivering on it. I see them perverting the meaning of the Ten Commandments. I think there's very little morality in letting people starve or trying to manipulate Social Security and get social insurance out of it. I see very little morality in Medicaid cuts or making health care unaffordable to the poor and making it look good.
Lisa, we've got it, and our time is short, but we appreciate your call. Chris Hedges, how do you respond there? This kind of goes to the holding the yardstick up against the entire country and its policies. You hear Lisa's complaint.
I think she's raised a very critical issue, You know, they often, the religious right bandies around this phrase, the right to life. I think the call of the commandments, just as I think finally the call of the gospels, is about the responsibility for life, and that, you know, if you send a person away naked when you could clothe them, when you walk by them and let them freeze to death, when you see a person suffer hunger and do not feed them, and they starve, if you see someone in the peril of death and don't save them, it's as if you kill them. You know, the French philosopher Montesquieu talked about the principles governing social life, and he said for despotism that principle was fear. He said for democracy it wasn't freedom, but virtue. And it's this quality, rather than fear or ambition, that makes things work, finally, in a democracy. This private virtue that is often touted by the Christian right does not translate very often into public good, I think, as your caller has aptly pointed out.
But of course, you know, many people on the right would say, dear Chris, it says thou shalt not kill, and we want to take that seriously, when they talk about abortion, for example.
Well, I understand people who oppose abortion, but not people who oppose abortion and support the death penalty. That seems to me a tremendous contradiction. I mean, Dorothy Day, a wonderful social activist and writer, opposed abortion and opposed the death penalty. That makes sense to me. Mm. But they want to expand the death penalty for the use of what they call moral crimes. Mm. That seems to me the height of hypocrisy.
Chris, our time is short here. We've just got a couple of minutes. Many people think of the Ten Commandments and they think of a severe, commanding God. You write that these commandments, tough and straightforward as they are, ultimately lead to love. Draw that map for us.
Well, because when you nurture, sustain, and promote community, when you care for the outcasts, when you care for people who are weak or suffering or hurting, that's what love is. That I think too often, some religious people make faith their aim. They think that, and they define faith as infallible doctrine. And this forms a kind of dogmatism that is not only exclusive, but intolerant. And I think by shutting out that inclusiveness, the primacy and importance of community, you're crushing love itself. And I think that that's what ultimately the commandments are calling us towards, is a life where we nurture, protect, preserve, and promote life through self-sacrifice, rather than creating idols to ourselves and perhaps our nation.
Chris Hedges, it is always illuminating to talk with you. You've taken 10 very old commandments and put them in very contemporary, very real American circumstances. It's a fascinating book, and we thank you for your time tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Chris Hedges, author of the new book, Losing Moses on the Freeway, The 10 Commandments in America. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Katie Bacon, Yotam Barkai, Susanna Dillplane, Michael Garth, Marika Bukas, Tim Skoke, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.